38, 35 Kenosha, 34 Racine, Winchell, one above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
On today's program, we're taking a few moments to remember a beloved member of the Carthage faculty, Dr. Thomas Knorr, who served for several decades as the Valor Distinguished Professor in the Humanities and Professor of History at Carthage College. He was one of my favorite faculty colleagues. We saw each other all the time in the Johnson Arts Center, and it was always a pleasure to speak with him. And on three different occasions, I had the great privilege of having him as a guest on the morning show. The last occasion was to talk about various epidemics in American history. We had that conversation during the COVID pandemic. I also had a conversation with him about a fascinating book called Soapy, a biography of G. Menin Williams, one of the most refreshing political figures in recent American history. That was just one of three books that Professor Knorr wrote, along with many, many articles. And those of you who live here in southeastern Wisconsin perhaps remember as fondly as I do the many wonderful guest columns that he wrote for the Kenosha News. In addition to being such a capable member of the Carthage faculty for so many years, Tom Knorr was also very active in the community. In fact, he served as a member of the Board of Directors for the Kenosha History Center, for the Kenosha Public Library, and for Grace Lutheran Church. He is survived by his wife, Linda, who was also a treasured member of the Carthage faculty for many, many years. Carthage is honoring the legacy of Dr. Tom Knorr with a special memorial fund to support Carthage students. And if you are interested in finding out more information and contributing to that memorial fund, you can go to give.carthage.edu, and you'll very quickly and easily find a link to this specific fundraiser designed to honor Tom Knorr and his great legacy. I want to honor his memory by replaying a memorable conversation which he and I had back in 2013. That year was the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and I seized the opportunity to invite Professor Knorr to our studios to offer his thoughts about President Kennedy and his place in history. Here is that conversation. Professor Knorr, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good to be back again.
Good to have you here. We're sort of scooping the Kenosha News here a little bit, I think, in that, as if I understand correctly, one of their reporters interviewed you for a fairly extensive article about John F. Kennedy that is going to be running at some point soon in the paper. And you were telling me off the air that you pulled no punches in offering your frank assessment of who John F. Kennedy is.
Yeah, the Kenosha News is doing an article about the Kennedy legacy, and they interviewed a number of people, some who are very pro-Kennedy, some who are more critical of Kennedy. And they were intrigued not only with what he did, but the image we have of Kennedy, particularly younger people's image of Kennedy. I suspect I came off probably more critical of Kennedy than the other people they interviewed. But I did acknowledge the fact, as you mentioned, that we are still fascinated with the Kennedy years. Whether you love or hate Kennedy, we're intrigued with that brief Camelot moment, as Arthur Schlesinger said, between kind of the dim, dark 50s and then all the horrendous things that followed, Vietnam, racial riots, disorder. And we look back at the Kennedy years as sort of this brief shining moment when there was elegance and class and youth and vigor. And I think all of that's important, but I think you also have to go back and say, well, yes, but what actually did he accomplish? What was his presidential heritage aside from the image? And I think that's where I part ways with some other people, and that I agree that the Kennedy image is impressive and intriguing. He was young, he was vigorous, he had an elegant wife, he was articulate. But underneath that, the substance to me is just not as strong as many Kennedy backers believe, that his accomplishments don't match up to the image.
You would have been old enough during that brief shining moment, right? not all that old, but you were. I was three when Kennedy was assassinated. So
I was a freshman in college.
Oh, okay. So I wonder. You're obviously a professor of history and a historian, and used to viewing things through the lens of history. And I wonder though what your memories are of John F. Kennedy as he lived and as you experienced him as a young person, and how that squares with the way in which you view him now.
That's an intriguing question, because historians are not supposed to write or think about anything they remember. We're supposed to be objective and neutral and biased, which in my case gets more and more difficult because I get older and older and older. But I remember Kennedy in 1960 when I was in high school, and how excited we were, particularly with the idea of his youth and his energy. Again, I was not politically active, but I was very intrigued by Kennedy. And I was a true believer. I really thought this is going to be a major change in America. The Eisenhower 50s, where I grew up, were going to be replaced by a period of excitement and glamour. And then with the assassination, I remember, we have to remember that the stunning effect of this and the effect of television showing the Jackie with the blood on her dress and showing John John's farewell salute to Kennedy at the funeral and showing Lee Harvey Oswald be assassinated. All of that, in a sense, was new to America. Now we see violence and assassination everywhere. But it was stunning. I remember walking around campus, and we didn't know what to do or what to say. We wandered to the chapel. We couldn't figure out what people were there for. And then we heard rumors that Lyndon Johnson had been killed. And it's I think, much a moment. People talk about Pearl Harbor, 9/11. I think the Kennedy assassination still occupies that space for people of my age and sort of a coming, a rude awakening about America. And then again, as an historian, I've gone back now and tried to overcome that sort of infatuation with Kennedy, even though I still am intrigued with the guy, and say, you know, despite the excitement of the election and the glamour and the assassination, what about the actual accomplishments? But it did fix, and I suspect young people today, maybe 9/11 will occupy that position. For some people, it's the death of Martin Luther King. But for people my age, who was 17, it was Kennedy's assassination.
How much have you actually written about Kennedy over these intervening years? I mean, is he in the arena that you have focused much of your energies
my
as a historian?
Yeah, my major is 20th century America, particularly American foreign policy. And first books that were American foreign policy in Africa. And I did a lot about Kennedy's approach to Africa, his approach to neutralism, his ideas about the Cold War. And then I did a chapter in a book on American presidents where I wrote a chapter called A Hero Idea of History, the Presidential Years of John F. Kennedy. And then the book that you graciously plugged, Soapy was Kennedy's Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. And so I went back and looked at Kennedy again. I published about 7 or 8 articles about Kennedy's policies, particularly foreign policy, which is what he specialized in. So I've done a lot of my work on Kennedy and Johnson particularly.
Maybe you could just say a quick word about the work that somebody like you or other historians that care about the truth do when it comes to a figure like John F. Kennedy, where there is this veneration that surrounds him. To any significant degree, does that make it difficult then to write objectively about him? I mean, to what do you turn for, in a sense, the unvarnished truth that is separate from that veneration?
It's hard because when Kennedy was assassinated, the first books that came out by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was his historian in residence, Ted Sorensen, who was a speechwriter, were laudatory, incredibly positive Kennedy. And then you had a period of historians, in a sense, very revisionist. Tom Reeves, I mentioned, who's professor at Parkside, wrote a book called The Question of Character, which was a rather unmitigating attack on Kennedy's personal life and character. Seymour Hersh wrote The Dark Side of Camelot. But now I think we're coming back to trying to be a little more balanced in the Kennedy years. And particularly my students, they recollections of Kennedy, of course, they obviously weren't even born when Kennedy was killed. They remember, again, much of the image, and particularly they remember the assassination. They remember the Jackie. They remember the family. They're not particularly interested in hearing about Bay of Pigs invasion or Cuban Missile Crisis or the fallout shelter scare or the Berlin Wall. They want to hear about pillbox hats. Mm. They want to hear about Hyannisport. They want to hear about Kennedy. And particularly when you get into the sexual side of Kennedy, they're intrigued with it. They're not appalled. They're fascinated with that. He would have all these affairs and Marilyn Monroe and many others. So it's difficult not to be caught.
I mean, not be
Everybody knew, but that was the times back then. He didn't talk about that. And the early biographers don't even, of course, mention that. Mm. Schlesinger never says anything about that. He said it didn't affect his presidential actions, which others, like Reeves, say it did. Mm.
As you were just mentioning what your current students at Carthage think about Kennedy, them not being born, even born when he was killed, it just occurs to me, many of their parents, the parents of current Carthage students, would not have been born yet when Kennedy was assassinated. So that's how far removed he is.
But it's interesting that they know much more about Kennedy than Lyndon Johnson, Eisenhower, Nixon. Even though Eisenhower and Nixon and Johnson may have had more impact on American history, but they know Kennedy. And they know it partly through, again, images. They all know the assassination. They all know ask not what your country can do for you. They all know we shall land a man on the moon. They all know Kennedy's image and good looks. Where with Johnson and Nixon, it's very hazy. Johnson is an enigma to them. Nixon, maybe Watergate, but they don't know anything else about it. But they have much more sort of interest and knowledge about Kennedy than others.
Mm. We're speaking with Professor Tom Knorr from the History Department at Carthage College, talking today about John F. Kennedy as the 50th anniversary of his assassination approaches. Professor Knorr, before we went on the air, you were talking about how there is, to some extent, a disconnect between how the public views John F. Kennedy and ranks him in the pantheon of presidents versus the typical historian and or political science professor looking back, viewing him in a very different way. Tell us just how different those appraisals tend to be.
Well, yeah. If you look at public opinion polls, and I recently reviewed a book where it was a very pro-Kennedy book, and I was trying to explain this. The general public always rates Kennedy as one of the greatest presidents. He's always in the top 10, sometimes in the top 3 or 4, after Washington, Lincoln, Franklin, Roosevelt, Kennedy. Historians poll themselves endlessly, and we rate presidents, and Kennedy now has dropped to kind of the lower half. Mm. Historians can't figure that out. Why does the public love Kennedy, where historians tend to be much more critical of Kennedy? And I think it's, again, it's partly because what we talked about is that the general public doesn't particularly care about all the details of his policies. They respond more to the general image and the sort of style of Kennedy. Where historians, even though we're supposed to be looking at objectively, tend to look more at the specific policies and actions and less influenced by the style. But ultimately, it's the public that prevails. No matter what we say, public is going to still want to have the Kennedy years as sort of this glamorous 1,000-day Camelot, which Arthur Schlesinger called it, his biographer. This brief glimmering moment which should not be forgotten, known as Camelot. That's how he ends his book. Historians say, well, there was, as Seymour Hersh said, a darker side of Camelot. Let's look at some specific policies and actions. But I think ultimately the public is going to create the Kennedy they want, and the historians are create the Kennedy that we see, and the public is going to impose their view in the past more than we impose our view on the public.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about where John F. Kennedy came from. I don't mean geographically where he came from, but the family he came from, and in particular, his father, Joseph Kennedy, and his insatiable hunger for greatness for himself and for his family, and particularly for his sons. How much should we think about Joseph Kennedy when we think about John F. Kennedy?
A lot. There's a recent book called Patriarch, which is a biography of Joe Kennedy. And it shows not only his influence on his children, but the fact we forget Joe was incredibly rich and powerful. But he always saw himself as an outsider. He was a Catholic in Protestant New England. He was a self-made man. He wasn't an inherited wealth. And he was desperate to achieve not only success, but prestige and power, and not only through his own career, but through his children's career. And in a sense, the key to all the Kennedy family is Joe. Not only in terms of pushing his kids, and he was incredibly driven to make his children successful, and he talked about the incredible competition he put them through and rigorous. And when his eldest son died, then John became the heir. And when John died, then Bobby. And when Bobby died, Teddy. But the fact that he had to overcome for this idea that he was an outsider, he was a Catholic, a self-made man in the sort of old traditional New England, and he was going to show the world that his kids could succeed. There's a wonderful story at the inaugural when John Kennedy, the president, is driving past the reviewing stand, and his father is in the reviewing stand. His father stands up and tips his hat to John. And John stops the motorcade, stands up, tips his hat to Daddy.
Wow.
That really characterizes the Kennedy. And he felt, in a sense, almost a love-hate thing with his father. He understood the importance of his father, but he also felt the father was relentless in this pursuit of excellence and power. And Kennedy wanted to run for politics, but I don't think he had a choice. Mm. Teddy, we don't want to get off Bobby, but Teddy didn't particularly want to go into politics, but it was his role now to carry on. Hmm. So,
one of the hallmarks of Kennedy's early life, of course, because so much of his life was relatively carefree, and in some respects he was a little bit of a lightweight compared to his older brother, who ultimately was killed. But certainly we see a different side of John F. Kennedy and have a sense of what he was made of when he is able to lead his men to safety after the sinking of PT-109. Do you feel, in the sort of the whole grand scheme of things, that is a story that is exploited or blown out of proportion in any way, or is that an important facet of who John F. Kennedy was as we assess him?
I think it was an important event. Obviously, Daddy and others used it to make his as a war hero, but he was truly a war hero. It was an heroic event. And again, we don't go into details, but he basically swam 3 miles dragging a wounded Navy officer with him. He kept his men together until they were recovered. It's interesting that Kennedy was turned down for the service because of health problems. He had constant problems with Addison's disease, which is always hidden. Daddy arranged for him to get a commission in the Navy. He desperately wanted to be a hero, and he was. And again, then his brother volunteers for this incredibly dangerous mission because he wants to one-up John and winds up his plane exploding over the Atlantic. So I think it was an heroic event. It was made into a interesting movie with Cliff Robertson. But I think Kennedy was a war hero. You can argue why the PT boat got cut in half. Some say because he was a bad navigator. Mm. But certainly his actions. And you have to remember, Kennedy was an incredibly sickly kid. He nearly died twice. His back he was in constant pain. He was constantly under medication. This was all hidden because he didn't want to see as a sign of weakness. He blamed later all of his back problems on war injuries. Well, that's not true. But he was in constant pain during the war and afterwards. And I think the PT-109 incident was an actual case of heroic action and deserved the medal he got for it. Mm.
The American Experience special, which I know you watched last night and which I got to see before it aired, actually. One of the things I most enjoyed about it in terms of learning something I absolutely did not know was how young John F. Kennedy entered politics and how he wasn't exceptionally good at it just right from day one. I think some people, through the haze of history, think of him as such a natural that he just decided one day to go into politics and just started shaking hands and kissing babies, and the rest is history. And this documentary paints a more complicated picture than that. I mean, he really had to learn what it took and had to really hone certain gifts in order to become the politician he became.
He was a rich college kid from Harvard, skinny, not very articulate, running in kind of the blue-collar areas of Boston, and the political pros in Boston thought he didn't have a chance to win this election. He couldn't relate to the public. He was not a particularly good speaker. He didn't like going out shaking hands. He didn't like going to all of those ethnic clubs and things like that. And many thought he was going to lose when he was running for first for Congress. But he, in a sense, prevailed, and again, Daddy helped by printing 100,000 posters and putting a lot of money into the campaign. But you're right, Kennedy never lost an election. But that first one, when he ran for Congress, many thought he would lose. And then, he became very bored and impatient with Congress and decided to run for the Senate against Henry Cabot Lodge. And they thought, there's no way we're going to win this. The Lodges are sort of godlike. And again, he won that. And then 6 years later, decides to run for president. Incredibly ambitious. But he does evolve. You're right. If you look at Kennedy's speaking style, how he relates to the public, and you look at him in 1946, and you look at him in 1960, it is clearly an evolution. He knows how to become a politician. He was never comfortable out in the campaign shaking hands and all this stuff, but he did it. I think in the documentary there's film of him shaking hands with factory workers, first in 46 and then in 60 in Wisconsin. And you can tell he doesn't like doing this, but he's willing to do it because he's got this desire and ambition or drive to succeed, and it comes partly from Daddy, and by then I think it's partly from him too.
Well, and I think at some point in one of those scenes, somebody is quoting Joe Kennedy as standing and seeing his son do that across the street, and he says, "I never thought I'd live to see the day." I mean, much as he wanted John to do that, Joe Kennedy probably had a hard time believing that that was something that John would ever be willing to do.
If you want to get into psychoanalytical theory on the Kennedys, obviously Daddy felt that the eldest son was the one that was going to do this. He wasn't ever sure that John was up to it, but he eventually becomes convinced that John can do it. And you're right, that election shows him that John has the potential maybe to do what Daddy wants him to do. Daddy's the puppet master, but the puppet becomes powerful himself by the 50s.
And another interesting moment in the documentary, I think, is in 1956, when John F. Kennedy comes pretty darn close to becoming the vice presidential running mate to Adlai Stevenson in the second of his two unsuccessful runs at the president's against Eisenhower. And that, in the moment, is a very disappointing loss. But I don't remember who is close to him who really says, this is the best thing that could have happened.
Daddy.
Oh, is that who it's? Okay.
Yeah, Kennedy, again, his ambition was almost unsatiable by 56, and he probably thought Stevenson was going to lose, but he wanted to be the vice presidential, and Stevenson threw it open to the convention, which is unusual back then, and Kennedy finally could mobilize and lost Estes Kefauver, and Daddy said, the best thing that ever happened to you. You'd be seen as a loser. Better now to set out this and come back 4 years later, and he did. But by 56, you began to see Daddy and John sort of going their separate ways. Daddy didn't want him to run for the vice presidency, but he felt that this would be a stepping stone 4 years later, and he loses the vice presidency. And Daddy says, see, I told you so. Now you can. And he spends the next 4 years running for the presidency and gets nominated in 60 and wins a narrow, narrow victory.
About that victory in 1960, how much do we really know? I mean, certainly a lot has been said about perhaps certain shenanigans that helped ensure that victory. Just how careful an analysis has been done about that? And at this point, is it possible for us to know? if in fact that election was won fairly or not.
Well, you're talking largely about Chicago and the Daily, and supposedly, and again, this is probably apocalyptic, Mayor Daley was asked, how many votes do we need for Kennedy to win? He said, that's easy. I can find that many votes. But Kennedy would have won the election without Illinois. He had enough electoral votes even if he hadn't carried Illinois. Mm. There were a lot of debate about that. But the big thing is, in 60 is, I think the TV show, and historians have pointed out, was the dramatic influence for the first time of television, the TV debates in 1960, which are always hailed as showing finally the incredible power television now has over our politics, which it does today. Mm. We forget how primitive it was back then. And that Kennedy prepared for the debates because he had TV advisors as a TV show. He wore a dark suit. He ignored Nixon, stared right in the camera. He kept his answers short. Nixon, who was a debater in college, looked at Kennedy, shifted back and forth, had bad makeup, wore a gray suit. It was all, again, image. And Marshall McLuhan uses this to talk about the importance of television. And as the documentary pointed out, those who listened to the radio strongly felt that Nixon had won the debate. Those who watched TV overwhelmingly felt Kennedy had won. And it shows that, again, in television, it's image. And Kennedy understood exactly how to use television. Nixon was still the old Nixon, you know, gunfighter type, and that didn't work on TV.
Hmm. When I look back at the Kennedy years, I think if there's anything that sweeps aside any reservations that I have about really what kind of president was he, it is when I watch the press conferences. We are told in the documentary that airs tonight, this part two, that I believe this was the first time in history that presidential press conferences were televised and televised live.
Mm-hmm.
And John F. Kennedy, for whatever else you might think about his limitations, was masterful in these situations, and leaves me so hungry to see more. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love for somebody to put on DVD just hours and hours of these press conferences. I mean, I'm serious about it.
You're a political junkie.
well, but I think even if you're not particularly interested in politics, just seeing somebody in that really high-pressure, high-stakes situation just handle one question after another so articulately and with such grace and often with such wonderful wit, I'm just that to me is what sort of shines in my mind almost more than anything.
You have to remember that, you know, Eisenhower had press conferences, but they were rambling, disjointed, and there's a famous story where he told his secretary, I'll go out and confuse him. And then Lyndon Johnson had press conferences, but they were wooden and very artificial. Kennedy, you're quite right, was a master of the media. He could cater his responses to a very short, brief clip, which is what TV wants. And it was a sense of danger because you're open to any question you want. But again, the media back then was a little more tame than it is now. But you're right. Again, it's back to the style and the image. And Kennedy was a masterful of that. Eisenhower was kind of seen as this blundering general. Johnson was never very articulate in front of TV cameras, but Kennedy was brilliant at handling the press and brilliant at using the press to make statements of it, to help him in his foreign policy and other things. But he would plant questions, and of course everybody does that, and he would have very poised and sharp responses to him.
Hmm. So when you look at the 1,000 days that John F. Kennedy was president, do you see a very mixed bag, or do you see mostly the negative? I mean, I think you've made it pretty clear right now that you do not see that that presidency as this luminous, shining moment of one great accomplishment after another. How would you characterize your overall assessment of that presidency?
Well, again, I'm quite critical of Kennedy on a number of things. We forget, for example, the tension of the Kennedy years. Bay of Pigs invasion, which Eisenhower planned but Kennedy implemented. The Berlin Wall, which was Khrushchev's attempt to test Kennedy. Cuban Missile Crisis, which was as close as we've come to blowing up the world. The attempt to assassinate Castro, Operation Mongoose, where we tried to overthrow the government of Cuba, fallout shelter crisis, all of this. We tend to gloss over that because we don't want to be reminded of the disasters and the tension of the Kennedy years. And again, the issue that I find most upsetting with Kennedy, which we talked a little before, was his idea about civil rights. We forget that Kennedy was never morally committed to the civil rights movement. He wanted to focus on foreign policy. He deferred civil rights to his brother, Bobby. He did not protect civil rights workers in the South. He appointed segregationist judges in the South. He tried to call off the march in Washington because he thought it embarrassed the government. He allowed the FBI to wiretap Martin Luther King, which they used to blackmail King. Now, eventually, he does evolve and gives a very memorable speech after the march in Washington in favor of civil rights. But to me, one of the great shortcomings of him was that he never saw civil rights as a moral issue. It was a legal, it was a political issue. He needed Southern votes. He needed the Southern senators to support his foreign policy. He was never committed to using the power of the government to enforce civil rights. He didn't try to pass the Civil Rights Act, but again, it was Lyndon Johnson, ironically the Southerner, who gets this through. So now, let me balance that. I can criticize his militancy and mistakes in foreign policy, his lack of commitment to civil rights, but there is something about youth, energy, dare we use charisma, glamour, that does stick with the Kennedy legacy, and I think that's important. Substance is important to historians, but style is also important to historians. You can talk of people like Teddy Roosevelt, who combined substance with style. Franklin Roosevelt had a lot of substance, but a lot of style. Kennedy, I think you have to acknowledge the fact that he revitalized the office. Again, his youth, which we forget how young Kennedy was. Eisenhower was born in the 1890. Kennedy said this is the first 20th century president. He made that clear.
That's right, born in 1917.
All this talk about youth and vigor, 50-mile hikes, the Peace Corps, all of these stress youth and idealism. And I think that's one reason why the assassination had such a dramatic impact on young people, is they saw Kennedy as one of our own. He's a young guy. He's a World War II vet. He's not. He is bringing new energy and vigor. And I think you can't dismiss that as a historian, even though I can say, well, I don't think he did a good job on the Bay of Pigs invasion. But I also admit, yeah, there was something to having Robert Frost read a poem at his inauguration, Pablo Casals playing in the White House, Jackie Kennedy's glamorous tours of the White House. That's important. And I think the image of Kennedy is important, and we don't want to let that go. And so we remember that. We don't remember the Berlin Wall. We remember Jackie going to Paris.
So it does.
I suspect a little skepticism from Mr. Berg on that response.
I'm surprised. I didn't see that coming. That you would argue so forcefully that those matters of style matter. It's the way you were characterizing it makes it sound like it actually matters quite a lot.
Maybe I want it to matter like everybody else does. We need a Kennedy to fit what we want. And what we want is kind of this brief shining moment of Camelot. And you can have that and still say, well, he was mediocre in civil rights. His foreign policies were overly militant. He was not particularly interested in domestic affairs. He told Nixon, who cares about the minimum wage? We're going to remember people by their foreign policy. And again, the article I wrote called The Hero Idea of History, Kennedy wanted to be a hero. He read when he was ill all his these biographies of people like Melbourne and Marlborough and Churchill. He wanted to impose upon history himself. He wanted to be a hero. And that's why he was in some kinds reckless in his foreign policy. He saw foreign policies often, he against Khrushchev, he against Castro, mano a mano. And he really did want to go down as a hero. And ironically, he goes down as a hero because he's shot. Not because what it is. And that's what fixes our image. And again, that's why this fascination that had Lee Harvey Oswald missed, how would history have been changed? And you can always say, well, we would not have had Vietnam. We wouldn't have had the urban riots. We wouldn't have had the assassinations, all the traumas that followed the 60s. And again, one of the intriguing things is that we can never disprove that. I'm not convinced it would have been all that different, but I think you can make a nice argument that, well, history would have been different had Oswald missed it. We're talking about a number of books that have tried to make that argument. Stephen King's thing, saying, had Kennedy lived, the world would have been different. And that's one of the kind of the intriguing things about Kennedy is we'll never know.
Mm. I remember one of the first times I thought about this was when I was reading a book that my father owned called The Kennedy Wit. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Yeah.
Small little paperback, and I think there was a sequel to it as well, but this was full of relatively brief excerpts from speeches and lots of things he said in press conferences and so on. And even as, you know, quite a young person, I loved reading this book. And I remember at one point in the book, The Kennedy Wit, Kennedy is quoted as saying something to the effect that if I win a second term, I'll finish out at a very awkward age. That would be 1968-69. Too old to get a new job and too young to write my memoirs. And I remember thinking, you know, even way back when, that would have been strange for John F. Kennedy to serve a second term and to live all of that out. And when he would have been done, he would have been roughly 50 or 51 49. Or something like
that. Yeah.
And what would that have been like? And because, of course, the assassination in Dallas fixes him in our minds as...
It's hard to think of an old John Kennedy.
It really
is. It's hard to think of an old James Dean, to date myself back to the 50s. We think of an old Elvis, and we say, oh, we like the young Elvis. Mm. But the fact that we never saw him old, he's always fixed in our mind as this young, vibrant guy who's gunned down in his life. And I think, again, that's part of the attraction of Kennedy. He was perpetually young. We'll never see him older. We saw Jackie age very gracefully.
Mm.
Bobby Kennedy, same thing. He's gunned down at a young age. And I think that's part of the attraction of the Kennedy years, is that not only was he young when he started, he was young when he died. And I think the youth is part of the appeal of Kennedy.
Mm.
But again, what are we going to do? You know, what did Bill Clinton do? He went on, started his foundation, ran around. What's Barack Obama going to do? He's going to be a very young guy when he's out of office. What do we do with ex-presidents? They give speeches and make a lot of money. They write their memoirs, but then what?
Mm-hmm.
So very intriguing what Kennedy would have done. And again, many say, well, he would have passed the throne on to Bobby. It was clear that that was the next in line. And then Bobby would have passed it to Teddy. And good Lord, we'd had Kennedy-esque forever.
Mm. Let's talk about the assassination for a moment.
Do we have to?
We do. I wonder if you could just say a word about the public's fascination with that. I mean, not only fascination with Kennedy himself, but then fascination with the assassination itself and how quickly all kinds of theories emerged about that being a much more complicated, murkier story than we were officially told. And you would have witnessed a lot of that firsthand.
It won't end. Again, I teach a course in the 1960s, and students do projects, and many of them want to do the Kennedy assassination. I said, it's the one topic you can't do.
Hmm.
It's been done. But it starts almost right after the Warren Commission comes out with Mark Rudd, who wrote a book about the first book criticizing the Warren Commission. And it's a industry that's grown for 50 years. And we have incredible numbers. It was the CIA that killed Kennedy. It was Castro that killed Kennedy. Kennedy died because we assassinated Diem in Vietnam. It was Texas oil miners that killed Kennedy. It was right-wingers that killed Kennedy. And again, there's a wonderful book called Case Closed by Gil Prosner that goes through all of these and says, no, 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 no. There was no grassy knoll. There was no second shot. But people don't want to hear that. We can't wrap our mind around that one crazy guy, Lee Harvey Oswald, who we really don't know that much about, managed to kill Kennedy on his own and then gets killed by another crazy guy, Jack Ruby. We have to see, there has to be something more going on than that, whether it was the CIA or the military or Castro. And so it won't go in. I just don't know why we're so intrigued. Why can't we accept the fact Well, Kennedy was so young and brilliant and bright. How could he be killed by such a weird misfit as Oswald? And even there's things that Lyndon Johnson killed Kennedy. The FBI killed Kennedy. I don't find any evidence to support any of that. But people find in the past what they want to find. Mm. And they find any number of conspiracies. We're still around. And I'm sure this year there will be more books about different conspiracy theories.
Mm. I'm so intrigued by what you just said, because it ties it together in a way that never occurred to me before. The fact that, going back to my question, we have this insatiable fascination about Kennedy himself. We also have this fascination with the assassination and the possibility of some conspiracy. I'd never really linked the two together in the way that you just did. It's the fact that if in fact we venerate Kennedy in this way as this larger-than-life Camelot figure, well then of course the notion of just one lunatic misfit destroying all that, I mean, that just is offensive to us.
We need to have our myths perpetuated. We need to have something bigger than one crazy assassination. History fills a need, and what we need in history is the image of Kennedy, and we need to have something more than one lone crazy guy do it. And so we're naturally drawn with, there has to be a little more elaborate, some more complicated than just one assassin. And again, the fact that Oswald's killed fuels this more, because, well, then there's Ruby's part of it, and Ruby's tied to the mafia, and on and on and on and on. And once you start down that path, you wind up with Oliver Stone's JFK. Mm. Great movie, terrible history.
Right. Yeah, very well put. I got to interview for this program Vincent Bugliosi.
Oh, yeah. He wrote a book about the Kennedy.
Absolutely. And one of the things that he ends up saying in this book is that you can start all kinds of conspiracy threads, conspiracy theories, but there is absolutely not a single one that you can follow to the end and have it remain consistent. And essentially, what conspiracy theorists do is they start a thread and they take it as far as they can, and the moment it becomes inconvenient or becomes complicated, or that thread falls away or no longer makes sense, then you just sort of drop it and you move on to another thread.
Or you say, well, then, see, the government covered up the rest of this. We can't find the rest of this. The CIA, the FBI, fill in the blank, has eliminated this evidence. But you're quite right. We can take it so far, and then you say, well, the rest of the evidence obviously has been suppressed, eliminated, even though I think he's right and Posner's right. If you follow these to the logical end, they don't prove the case. But we want to read those, just like we want to go to certain movies, we want to read certain types of books, because we don't want, you know, the simple explanation. We want it to be more complicated.
Right. So, good movie, bad history. So, you're in the business, of course, of good history. Do you find that it is difficult, as you, for instance, are working with students, with all that is sort of out there for them to be taking in? Is it hard
assassination
create?
Or Kennedy?
Or just Kennedy in general, too? I mean, is
both,
it?
Both. As I said, students are very intrigued with Kennedy. They're intrigued with the personality and all the things I talked about. They don't want particularly to deal with the issues. They want to deal with the assassination. They're intrigued with that issue. Some of them have seen the Stone movie, or they have sort of theories about assassination. But they find Kennedy fascinating, but they tend also to have a preconceived notion of what they're going to find. They're going to find Camelot. And they find other things, and they tend to gloss that over. As I said, they don't have that problem with other historical figures, particularly more recent ones, as I said, like Johnson or Nixon. But they have very strong images of Kennedy that comes maybe from their TV, maybe from movies, maybe from their parents, maybe from all those endless photograph books of Kennedy. But they have strong images of Kennedy, and I think they're not alone.
Well, we leave it there for now, and I think we've given our listeners quite a lot to continue to think about.
I don't hate Kennedy.
No, clearly. I mean, you're as interested in him as most of the rest of us are, and are just trying to view him through the lens of a true historian. And I really appreciate you sharing your perspective on John F. Kennedy today.
Thank you.
This has been very interesting. Dr. Thomas Knorr, a professor of history at Carthage College. Dr. Thomas Knorr served for many years at Carthage as the Valor Distinguished Professor in the Humanities and Professor of History. He passed away on March 29th of this year at the age of 79. Carthage College has created a memorial fund to honor his legacy. And if you are interested in contributing to that fundraiser, you should go to give.carthage.edu. I'm Gregory Berg. We remind you that a special fund has been created in memory of Dr. Thomas Knorr, and you can go to carthage.edu and find through the giving page more information about that. As we remember special people, I want to draw your attention to tomorrow's podcast version of the morning show. Earlier this year, I believe it was back in September, a man named John Stuig passed away. And John Stuig is an important part of recent Carthage history because John Stuig in 2004 became the director of the Center for Children's Literature at the Hedberg Library and helped bring to Carthage a collection that features more than 25,000 different volumes of children's literature. And under his direction, John Stuig helped to bring a number of noteworthy children's book authors and illustrators to campus. And he arranged for a number of them to be guests on the morning show, something which I very deeply appreciated. Tomorrow on the podcast version of the morning show, you will hear my first conversation recorded with John Stuig back in 2004, in which he looks back over his life, his career in library science and the work that he did. And then on Sunday, on a sadder note, I'm replaying my conversation with Catherine Newman, the author of a book called Rampage, which looks at the phenomenon of school shootings and in particular why over the years so many of those kind of events have occurred in either rural settings or settings in which one would not expect anything like that to occur. And of course, we're resharing that conversation in the wake of the unhappy events in Madison less than a week ago. The podcast is called The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It is available through all of the platforms in which you can receive podcasts. And even though our studios will be closed all next week because of the holidays, there will be a different Morning Show podcast each and every day. Again, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Now to the weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. Windy conditions today, and some lingering lake effect snow is likely in parts of our listening area, ending early this afternoon. Total accumulation 3 to 4 inches. Then partly sunny and seasonal by mid to late afternoon. Today's high, 33 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight, but we're going to drop all the way down to 11 for an overnight low. So get that snow off the ground, off the pavement, before it turns to ice. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 23. Sunday partly sunny with a high of 29. Warming into the upper 30s Monday. This is WG.